Blog Talk Radio.
Dallas, Texas, on Wednesday, August the 9th, with the music of my good friend Carlos Guedes from Venezuela. We get another show started. Tonight we're going to be checking with our friend Barry Jacobson, military historian. We're going to continue our series of shows about World War II. As you may remember, the last time we left off was in the winter of 1942. Well, we're going to pick it up once again in the winter of 42-43. Not a good winter. For anybody, really. I think it was a difficult time for the Germans. It was a difficult time for the Russians. It was a difficult time for the British. I mean, it was one of those moments in World War II where nothing was going right for anybody, and that there was a great deal of anger and frustration among the different different countries in the war. So we're going to be talking about that. We're also going to meet one of the great personalities, one of the great military personalities of World War II, and that's General Patton. We're going to be bringing him up. We brought him up a few shows ago when we talked about the military leaders of World War II, but tonight we're going to focus a little bit more on him and what exactly his role was. Of course, General Patton, for those of our generation, we probably got to know more about him because of that great movie that came out, I think it was in 1970, the great movie with George Scott playing General Patton. I think a lot of us probably got to know him because of that. It may have been for many of us the first time that we had ever seen or had ever read anything or seen anything or heard anything at all about General Patton. So today we're going to be hearing about General Patton. And we're also going to be looking back at that terrible winter of 1942-1943. Then in the second segment of our show tonight, we're going to talk a little bit about North Korea. If you've been following the news here over the last 24 hours, 48 hours, North Korea, the situation there is getting crazy and dangerous. And I'm not sure where it's all headed. I'm not really sure where it's all headed. There was a very interesting article this morning at the American Thinker about what a military conflict could look like. And it was rather interesting. I'm sure that Barry will bring that up today. We're also going to talk a little bit about Afghanistan. You know, we've been in Afghanistan now. It's going to be 16 years in October. And I have supported the mission. I'm one of those who supported the mission from day one. And I'm not necessarily calling for the withdrawal of American troops. I'm not doing that either. But I want to hear from Barry tonight as to what may be the way to go in the future in Afghanistan. How much more investment are we willing to make of not just obviously human resources, but as well as financial resources? We've been there for a long time, and maybe we've accomplished our objective, maybe not. I'd like to hear a little bit about that with Barry. And sometime tonight, before the end of the show, we'll look back at Light My Fire by The Doors, celebrating 50 years. It was 50 years ago this week that Light My Fire by The Doors was the number one song in the country. And I'm sure that Barry Jacobson, like a good baby boomer, has a good memory of Jim Morrison and The Doors. How are you, Barry?
I am good, and my memory is more or less intact.
Oh, so you haven't lost it. I will.
Not yet.
I will tease our listeners. I will be talking about Jim Morrison and The Doors in our second segment, but I will tease our listeners with a little story about Light My Fire. Not just Light My Fire, but the music that we grew up listening to. My father would always say to me, nobody's going to be listening to that stuff in 50 years. And I said, well, maybe so. Maybe so. So I think if my wonderful father was alive tonight, I think he would get a kick out of the fact that we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of a great song, Light My Fire. So we'll get into that in the second segment, but I wanted to get that in. My dad always said, nobody's going to listen to that stuff in 50 years. Of course, he was thinking of Beethoven and Frank Sinatra and all that kind of stuff that did survive 50 years and probably will survive another 50, another 100. But I just had to get that in, Barry, about Light My
Fire.
Well,
you did.
But I sure did. I wanted to get that in. Well, we've got a lot of history tonight to cover. I said in the introduction, I think before you came on, that in the winter of 42-43, I don't think anybody was very happy because nobody seemed to be doing very well. Everybody was sort of stuck in the snow, if I could put it that way, or stuck in the mud. And it was not a happy time for anybody. Would that be a fair way to present your presentation tonight or introduce your presentation tonight, Barry?
Well, perhaps. I would say there were a couple people that were probably happy. In January of that year, 1943, the Casablanca Conference was held. This was the conference in North Africa, in Morocco, recently captured by George Patton and his 1st Armored Corps during Operation Torch. And that was the first American effort in World War II, the capture of North Africa's Morocco coast and parts of Algeria. But the big three, Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin, and their staffs had their first big meeting face-to-face at Casablanca. This was on January 14th through the 23rd, 1943. And what came out of the conference was a term which I know you'll recognize, Silvio. It was unconditional surrender. At that point, the Allies announced that they would accept nothing but the unconditional surrender of Germany.
Hmm.
Now, this was kind of a good and a bad thing. The good was that it really reinforced morale by announcing boldly at a time when they really weren't winning the war that the Allies, far from surrendering, were demanding Germany surrender. Which is it's a bit of chutzpah. It's sort of like going into a Super Bowl and at halftime you're down by 10 points and
right,
you say
right.
The game is won. We won it. It's over.
Right.
But you could say that the big three were sort of happy, right?
Yeah,
kind of, I guess.
I didn't think of it that way. Yeah, you're right.
And that same month, Stalingrad surrendered. We talked about that last week. And in January and February of 1943 began horribly for the Germans. The Germans had begun the summer of 42 with their Case Blue offensive. They captured large amounts of southeastern Russia. They pushed into the Caucasus Mountains in an effort to capture the Russian fields around Baku, down by the Caspian Sea. And as we talked about last week, Zhukov counterattacked and surrounded Stalingrad, where 6th Army von Paulus was fighting. And by 43, by January and February 43, von Paulus was starved of supplies, and his army was forced to surrender. So we're going to begin tonight by talking about what happened and how the war at that point continued on in the east. And how the German effort was saved for at least a little while longer by a really remarkable military achievement.
Great. Well, let me give you the microphone, and you take it away.
Okay. Well, at the fall of Stalingrad, suddenly hundreds of thousands of Russian troops were freed up that had been fighting to destroy von Paulus. And between the Volga River and the Donets Basin, there was no German forces to stop them. And they poured east in huge numbers with hundreds and hundreds of tanks. And what the Russians called a deep penetration battle, where they penetrate deeply westward into the German lines, creating a gigantic rupture. And German eyewitnesses flying over the front in observation planes. One in particular was a general named von Mellenthin, who wrote a book later called Panzer Battles. And he said to his shock and horror, he looked down as he was flying over the snows of Russia between Stalingrad and the Don River. And there was nothing to be seen but thousands and thousands of Russian troops and tanks streaming westward and nothing to oppose them. The German armies south of that rupture in the Caucasus Mountains, particularly the 1st Panzer Army, were desperately trying to get their way back north so it wouldn't be cut off by the advancing Russians and forced to surrender as well. So the war very easily could have at that point been won by the Russians. Had 1st Panzer Army and with it 4th Panzer Army, which was defending valiantly the bridgehead across the Don River that the 1st Panzer Army would have to cross to get back to safety in the Ukraine. If they had failed, that would have been the end of German arms in South Russia, and probably the entire front would have collapsed, as it did years later, but it probably would have happened in early 43 after Stalingrad. That's how terrible a battle it was for the Germans. Now, step forward at that point, a brilliant man. Germany had conquered France in a matter of weeks, something they'd never been able to do in 1914, and throughout all World War I, for that matter, because of a plan devised by a staff officer named Erich von Manstein. Von Manstein's plan to conquer France was what was utilized by Hitler and his generals, and it was a bold plan to attack where no one thought they could, through the Ardennes Forest. You'll probably remember the Ardennes because we've all heard of the Ardennes offensive right. when it comes to the Battle of the Bulge, which will happen yes. in 1944.
That was still going to happen a couple of years later, right? We're still a couple of
exactly.
years. That was in Christmas 1944, if I remember correctly.
Precisely. But that actual route of attack was used by the Germans in 1940, 4 years earlier, by Manstein and his plan to conquer France. The French armies and the British armies were advancing into Belgium, and the French Maginot Line of fortresses guarded the area south of the Ardennes all the way to the Swiss border. There was this one gap between the advancing Allied armies and their fixed fortifications along the German-Franco-German border, the Maginot Line, and that was through the Ardennes Forest. And it wasn't guarded because no one thought it was passable by tanks. And Manstein, of course, came with a brilliant plan to thrust deeply through the Ardennes, break through at Sedan, cross the Meuse River, and then drive for the English Channel. And then by doing that, cutting off the entire French and British armies that were pushing into Belgium to stop the Germans in Belgium. And that resulted in the Battle of Dunkirk, you know, the retreat of Dunkirk. The British had to withdraw from the continent desperately before they were encircled also and destroyed. So that was Manstein's introduction to the West. And he spent the next couple years really doing very little of note. He was commanding a armored corps at the beginning of Barbarossa in the north on the drive to Leningrad. He later was given command of the forces that were besieging Sebastopol in the Crimea. But at the fall of Stalingrad, Manstein was elevated and given command of all Army Group South. And as I just said, Army Group South was in terrible condition. With the destruction of 6th Army, there was a gaping hole hundreds of miles wide, and Russian troops deep in the German rear. It was so bad, in fact, that when Hitler flew east to meet with von Manstein at Zaporozhye in the Ukraine, they were having a conference on the airfield. Hitler had gotten out of his plane, walked up to Manstein, shook hands, they were talking, and Hitler looked over Manstein's shoulder and pointed. And there were tanks advancing across the open steppe towards the airfield. And those were Russian tanks advancing on the airfield, deep behind German lines. And that so shook up Hitler that he gave Manstein something he never gave any other general carte blanche before or after, and that was the freedom to maneuver. Hitler had this horrible fixation that he developed during World War I with the idea of holding ground. In World War I, as we remember from our stories about World War I, our series, that was a battle of inches. Every trench was desperately hung onto, and they'd fight for yards rather than miles. And Hitler was a soldier who had fought his way through World War I. So when it came to Russia, he thought in terms of World War I, that every inch had to be held onto. And that played into the Russian strength, which was a tenacious, toe-to-toe kind of slugfest. The Germans were really good at maneuvering. But to maneuver, you have to have the ability to give ground and then retake it. have the ability to lure your enemy into pockets and trap them. And he was so shook up by that encounter with Russian tanks about to overrun his airfield. And by the way, Hitler got back into his plane and flew away. But it gave von Manstein freedom to maneuver, to do whatever he needed to stop this disaster from unfolding. What followed was called the backhanded blow, or sometimes Manstein's miracle. And it's one of the greatest feats of generalship in World War II, even though ultimately it didn't save Germany from defeat. It just staved off defeat for a few years. What Manstein did is, as the Panzer armies were retreating from the Caucasus Mountains, he gathered them together south of the Russian breakthrough, right at the just north of the Sea of Azov, just to the east of Crimea, in the south of Ukraine, the area that nowadays is being fought over, in fact, in the Donbass, region, being fought over by the separatists with the Ukrainian government. That's where the Russians are pouring through. And he launched a series of counterattacks in March, late February and March of 1943. These drove deeply into the flank of the advancing Russian forces. The problem with a deep penetration offensive like the Russian doctrine called for is that if a defender can counterattack the base of the breakthrough, which they call the salient, the base of the salient, they can pinch off and cut off all those spearheads that have broken through. And that's exactly what happened. The Germans came up behind the Russians, broke through and came up behind them and started rolling them up from the rear. Russian tanks had a couple of disadvantages in those days. They're fine tanks overall. The T-34 was better than probably any other tank overall in the entire war. But one of the things the Russians lacked is each tank didn't have a radio. They couldn't talk to each other. And the only communication set was normally in a tank company commander's tank. It was a big antenna, which he was able to broadcast to and get orders from higher command. But he couldn't talk to his tanks. He had to get in front of them and lead them. They had to kind of follow him, follow like a line of ducks. The Germans were able to take advantage of that because every German tank had a radio and they could all talk to each other. So German tanks would maneuver up behind a column of Russian tanks and just start taking out from the rear. And the Russians would have no idea the Germans were behind them because they could only see their front and they couldn't talk to each other. So as one tank was being blown up, it couldn't warn his buddies that there were Germans behind them. And literally some 600 tanks were wiped out by von Manstein during this counterattack, and tens of thousands of Russian troops were captured or killed. Kharkov was recaptured. The whole Russian offensive was destroyed and thrown back. Kharkov was just the starting point for the drive north that would eventually have stabilized the entire front, except that Russia was saved by winter's thaw. They call that general mud. When in the spring, the snows thaw, and March came along, and the whole area turned to a sea of mud. And we've talked about this before with Russia. They have two thaws per year. And during those thaws, the autumn and spring thaw, the whole area is just a sea of mud. And so Manstein's offensive at the end of March had done amazing things. It had stabilized the frontier and saved the German army from complete defeat and bagged tens of thousands of Russians. But it stopped because of the mud, and both armies were able to regroup. And it left the Russians with a bulge in the German lines around the city of Kursk. And in the next episode, we're going to talk about the Battle of Kursk that resulted when Manstein, with hard, firm ground in the summer, was able to continue his attack.
And one of the things that you also wanted to mention, Barry, was about Patton and how Patton was introduced to the story about this time. Of course, we did talk about Patton a little bit when we did our military leaders. But tonight, I think you're going to do a little bit more about Patton.
Yes, because it all ties together in the next episode when with Patton and landing in Sicily in the Battle of Kursk. In 1940, early 43, the Americans were pushing through Algeria. Patton was sidelined. He was back in with 1st Tank Corps, still mopping up or reorganizing in Morocco. While 2nd Corps was advancing through Algeria towards Tunisia. Now, Tunisia was where the Germans had hundreds of thousands of troops. They were facing south towards Tripoli, towards Libya, for the most part, where Montgomery's 8th Army was advancing fairly slowly along the Libyan coast after winning the Battle of El Alamein the year before. The Germans were set up a line of a true facing south towards Libya with the idea of stopping Montgomery as he advanced up north towards Tunisia. The Americans were trying to come up behind the German lines and help Montgomery break through and capture Tunisia with the Second Corps, commanded by one of the most incompetent generals of all time, and at least American general of all time, a guy named Lloyd Friedendahl. Friedendahl was a clown. He was a show general, a politician in uniform. You probably can't say enough bad about his generalship and style of leadership. As his Second Corps advanced, he had units penny-packeted all over the countryside. And at the Kasserine Pass, which is the entryway from Algeria into Tunisia, he had his forces scattered all over the pass on both sides with no coherency, no overall command. He was a guy that seldom ever left his own bunker, seldom left his own command post. Didn't know really what was going on out there. He might have been a physical coward, as things turns out. Rommel, the Desert Fox, was in Tunisia, and he realized that the Americans were coming, and something had to be done to slow them down. So he prepared a spoiler attack. This is an attack that's meant to stop the enemy from launching their own counterattack, their own offensive. It's sort of imagine as a sort of a slap on the nose when a dog sticks its nose underneath the girl's skirt. You know, she slaps him on the nose, and he backs off. That's a spoiler attack.
I like that.
So the Americans were sniffing at Rommel's skirt. And he didn't much like that and didn't have to put up with it. So he launched a counterattack at Kasserine Pass. And this was launched on 26 February 1943. And for the Americans, it was a complete and utter disaster. Our first encounter with the Germans in force, our first meeting with Rommel, we had about 30,000 troops to Rommel's mere 22,000 troops. But he hit Friedendahl like a cyclone using classic blitzkrieg tactics. His forces well-controlled, supported by air power. And he just mopped up one small packet of American troops after another. Friedendahl never took overall command of his corps. And by the end of the battle, Second Corps was routed and driven back from Kasserine Pass. I told you that story, so I'm going to tell you this story. Rommel retreated at that point back into Tunisia. Again, ready to fight off Montgomery coming from the south. And the Americans got a little breathing room, and Friedendahl was fired, and Patton was put in command of Second Corps. And Second Corps, as you can imagine, was in deplorable condition. Morale was terrible. The men had just suffered a terrible defeat. Patton spent the next 2 weeks, and by the way, he had orders that within 3 weeks he had to be ready to fight. He spent the next 2 weeks getting to know his men and installing really Spartan discipline on the American forces. Patton was the most senior general in the American Army. He was one of the oldest generals in the American Army. Even though he was a very young, energetic spirit, he was a much older man than most of his contemporaries. Tall, ramrod, straight, an old cavalry soldier. He had chased Pancho Villa into Mexico in 1916, and reputedly shot a couple of Pancho Villa's men in a gun duel in a Mexican cantina with a six-shooter. So he was a real cowboy general. And he wouldn't let men, this is in the field, he wouldn't let men go out to the field without shaving first, without having their tie on. In those days, American Army soldiers, part of their combat uniform, both had wearing a tie of all things. Their boots had to be polished. He felt that if he didn't look like a soldier, he wouldn't fight like a soldier. So he made sure his men looked like soldiers and discipline was restored. He fired many of his officers that he inherited from Friedendahl, brought in his own staff and his own tactics. And it can be said of George Patton that he was a cavalry soldier who applied cavalry tactics to armored warfare, which, by the way, is in the best traditions of people like Rommel and Guderian on the German side. Because tanks are ultimately the maneuver element in battle, just like horses were back in the old days. And Patton understood that. So he got his first taste of battle against Rommel at the Battle of El Guitar, in which Rommel's subordinate, Rommel had gone back to Germany for health reasons. And he left his Panzer Army in command of a guy named Jürgen von Arnim. And General von Arnim was a pretty good general, but he was not Rommel. But he launched an attack on Patton's forces at a place called El Guitar in Tunisia as Patton was driving into Tunisia. He thought he'd get another second Kazarine pass. He'd rout the Americans, who they, but at this point, the Germans had no respect for. Thought the Americans were second-rate soldiers at best. And Patton had a trick for him. Patton had a trap prepared in which it was basically a pocket with his forces deployed in hiding in a horseshoe-shaped ambush in which the German 10th Panzer Division drove into this horseshoe, encountered a minefield which stopped their advance, and then were fired on from all sides, from three sides, by Patton's forces. It was a fairly bloody battle. Americans lost over 5,000 killed or wounded. Germans lost slightly more, about 6,000. But the Germans lost four-fifths of their tanks. 10th Panzer Division was gutted of its tank force. Americans only lost 25 tanks. And Patton had made his reputation as a commander of some repute by throwing back Rommel's vaunted Africa Corps. At this point, Patton was sent back to Tunisia, where he was getting ready to reorganize for the invasion of Sicily. His first tank corps was redesignated as the 7th Army with the objective of landing in Sicily. Tunisia would soon collapse. It would be the second Stalingrad, in which some 250,000 German troops would be forced to surrender as Americans and British under Montgomery were able to link up in Tunisia. He turned 2nd Corps over to Omar Bradley, a general we're going to hear a lot more about in the future. Bradley had been his subordinate when he was commanding at El Guitar, and Patton turned over 2nd Corps to Bradley and went off to form the 7th Army, which would soon be landing in Sicily. The landing in Sicily would happen in July of 1943. The Battle of Tunisia would end in June, in May, actually. And at the same time, in the summer of July of 1943, the Germans were launched their last great offensive on the Eastern Front as Manstein tried to regain the initiative he had won in his backhand blow on the Donets with the Battle of Kursk. And the two will come together, the attack on Sicily and the Battle of Kursk, in an unfortunate set of timings for Adolf Hitler.
All right. So what will be then, where do we pick it up the next time, Barry? Before we go on break,
we'll pick it up with Operation Citadel, the largest tank battle in the Second World War, Germany's last offensive on the Eastern Front.
And this took place physically where? What territory?
Just north of where Manstein's backhanded blow had been fought, which is to say the eastern Ukraine. In the northern part of the Ukraine and in and around the town of Kursk. And it would be the, as I said, the largest tank battle in history.
Wow. You know, whenever we're going to take a break and then come back in a few minutes, but I just wanted to say one thing. I'm always fascinated when you do these presentations and you talk about tank battles, because I think World War II must have been the place where tanks became prominent. I mean, I know there were tanks in World War I, and I'm sure we've had tanks since, of course. But it seemed like tank battles were more prominent in World War II, or at least from listening to your stories, I get that impression, Barry.
Yeah, they were, and you're absolutely right. We talked about in World War I presentations, we talked about George Patton when he was a young commander, a lieutenant colonel, in the Western Front, World War I, and the tanks in those days were huge behemoths. With no way of communicating with each other, no way of being communicating between the tank driver and the tank commander. Patton, in his tank in World War I, had to sit above his driver, and to get the driver to turn right or left, he had to kick him in the right shoulder or the left shoulder. And that's only the guy could tell whether to turn left or right.
I'm sure Patton got a kick out of that.
No pun intended.
Yeah, right.
But by World War II, the German panzers and later the Russian tanks, and by 1943, the American tanks were beginning to come, get pretty good. The tanks were getting much more sophisticated. Some of the later tanks were getting quite fast by, earlier standards. And tank tactics had become combined arms tactics. The Germans were the first, of course, to pioneer combined arms tactics, where a tank didn't fight on its own. The British were doing that all throughout the early part of World War II and getting their butt kicked by the Germans, even though they often had more tanks and better tanks, because they didn't support their tanks with infantry, artillery, and anti-tank weapons in close support. The Germans did. The Germans had a combined arms package. Everybody coordinated a fight together, and planes, low-flying tactical aircraft supporting everything from above. So, yeah, you find these great tank battles in World War II that were never seen before. Now, of course, by modern-day standards, battles like a Chinese farm in the Sinai during the 1973 war between Israel and Egypt, you have titanic tank battles there as well. And, of course, the attack on Kuwait in Desert Storm. The Third Corps was a massive armored attack against the Republican Guard. So, but World War II was the beginning of all these sort of battles where you have these combined arms, air and tank and infantry assaults, these sweeping maneuvers of tanks.
Right. No, it's fascinating because they've been running this Civil War series on that channel, American Heroes Channel. And these are recreations, I should say, of the battles. And it's so different how they used to fight during the Civil War. I mean, you can just, it's more the human body was the shield, you know. I mean, you were basically, it was you and the bullet, whereas I think in World War II you had tanks and you had much better protection for the soldiers, but nevertheless you still had huge casualties in World War II. Let me take a little break, Barry. When we come back, we're going to come to the present, and we're going to talk a little bit about some of these issues on the front pages today. We'll be right back. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, and we're chatting with our good friend Barry Jacobson tonight. We just completed another chapter of our story of World War II, but I do have one pending question that I didn't have a chance to get in, Barry. Just a quick question. How good was that movie Patton? I mean, I know that it was a good movie to watch, but how historically good was it for you who know so much about history?
I'm sorry, I missed the name of the movie. Which movie?
Patton.
Oh,
the movie with George C. Scott?
Yes. First of all, it's a great movie. It's one of the best
really
best war movies ever made. It's really a biopic more than anything else. The Battle of El Qatar, which we just talked about, is at least the first day of El Qatar. It went on for several days after that. But the first day of El Qatar is shown fairly accurately in that movie. It's Patton's first battle. But, yes, it's a great movie. And Patton, by the way, Patton didn't look or sound much like George C. Scott. George C. Scott imbued the spirit of Patton perfectly.
Right.
And he
right.
created a great portrait of Patton, but he doesn't look like Patton. Patton actually looks more like, almost like a brother of our current Secretary of Defense, General Mattis. It looks so much
like.
Oh, okay. It's Mattis. General Mattis. Just imagine Mattis is taller and leaner.
In fact, when I was looking for a picture, you know, we have this these pictures that we put on the show link. I was looking for a picture of Patton, and I had to be careful not to put one of George C. Scott because they have so many of them, and they're mixed. You know, they're mixed together. And I was thinking about that, and I said, well, I got to make sure I put Patton, not George C. Scott. But anyway, I wanted to, because I think you're right. It's a great movie, but I just, you know, sometimes great movies don't necessarily tell the story correctly, if you know what I mean. So I'm glad to hear from you that it was actually a pretty good movie. Well, let's go to what's going on the front pages today, Barry. And I wanted to ask you about Afghanistan first. That's a quicker topic to get to. I have supported our effort in Afghanistan going back to October of 2001 when President Bush started the war or retaliated for 9/11 by going into Afghanistan. And I've supported it. I I thought under President Bush we had a clear mission. Under President Obama we expanded the number of troops, but then we told them when we were getting out, which probably didn't make a lot of sense. And now we have a new president. We have some new, like you say, Mattis and defense and so on. And there seems to be a discussion as to what our next step should be. And I'm wondering what you think it should be. Should we continue to be there and fight this war? At what point do we say, you know what, we've done the best we could. Let's focus somewhere else, Barry.
Are you familiar with the story of the tar baby? Yeah, Briar Rabbit, the tar baby.
Go ahead and refresh my memory of that one.
Well, and it's an analogy often used that it's a tar baby. It means something that sticks to you and you can't get rid of it. Once you grab it,
okay.
You can't let go of the stuff to you.
And
that's Afghanistan. It's easy to get into and very hard to get out of. The British invaded Afghanistan 3 times during the 19th and then at the beginning of the 20th century, just after World War I. And they defeated the Afghans easily each time initially, but then got bogged down in a guerrilla war in some of the worst terrain in the world. Afghanistan is all mountainous or desert, and it's lots of high valleys and narrow passes, which lend themselves very well to ambushes. The population is scattered up in these mountains and passes and a myriad of little villages, each one which hardly ever talks to its neighbor. When they're not fighting us, they're fighting each other. It's a tough place to fight a war. And it's, by the way, it's a very high altitude, so it's tough on the troops, tough on their breathing, tough on their lungs, very harsh conditions. That said, you know, we've done pretty good. We've kept the Taliban from taking back the country from a really weak civilian government and a military which we spent a lot of money and time training up that doesn't seem to be able to do a very effective job at defeating the enemy. Now, that said, as I just said, this is an ideal place for a guerrilla movement and a guerrilla army to engage in a guerrilla war. It's very hard for a conventional force to defeat it, particularly when it has sanctuaries across the border. If you remember Vietnam, what made the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese so dangerous and hard to defeat was that they were able to slip across the border into Cambodia or Laos and escape our retaliation strikes. Whenever they attack us, they could then slip back across the border. Or they could stage attacks and stage supplies on the other side of the border. Well, the Taliban is doing the same thing in Waziristan and the tribal territories of Pakistan across the border. These are lawless areas where not even the Pakistani government can go. And these regions are just a natural sanctuary for the Taliban. You know, and then we got another problem. We could probably, if we want to send lots more troops in Afghanistan, we could probably expand the war into those tribal areas. We'd have twice as much problem. But we could do that if we want to try and knock out some of those sanctuaries. But that would just simply help to destabilize the Pakistani government at home with its own people, having foreign incursions into Pakistan. And Pakistan's a nuclear-armed nation, which
right.
has an unstable government already. We don't want that falling into the hands of an Islamic government. That would be a real disaster.
Right.
So basically the situation goes from bad to ugly and from ugly to hideous.
That's right. That's right. So in a sense, I guess for the time being, maybe what we're doing is the best we can do and maybe about as much as we can do. Better put it that way, about as much as we can do.
Well, it comes to the point of diminishing returns in any
sure.
in any human endeavor. You only get so much out of everything, only so much juice you can squeeze. And after you've squeezed, and you squeeze an orange, initially you get a lot of juice, but the more you squeeze, the less you get. And you have to apply even more pressure to get just a little bit more. That's the way warfare is. That's the way everything else in life is. We've gotten to the point of diminishing returns. All the effort in Afghanistan now gives us very little in the way of return. It would take a titanic effort. Another surge on at least a scale of what happened in Iraq to restabilize the country to the level it was before Obama. Obama let things get way out of control.
Right,
he cut
right.
back
I
our
think
forces
so.
Way too far.
Yeah. But not only did he cut them back, Barry, he sent the wrong signal. At least under Bush, I felt that we had the right approach under Bush in the sense that we didn't have a big footprint. but we kept these people running from cave to cave, if you know what I mean. We would target them and destroy them whenever we saw them or whenever they would show their face. With Barack Obama or President Obama, we said, we're going to go in, but by the way, we're getting out in 18 months. And that's probably not the message you want to send to the terrorist in Afghanistan. So I guess hearing what you're saying, it probably means that don't expect any big changes in Afghanistan anytime soon. That's kind of what I'm hearing from you.
Yeah, I would say, you know, from my position nowhere near the front and not privy to any intelligence that the president has, but from my position, I'd say I don't see any way to win this war, really. You're not going to defeat the Taliban. And Obama's strategy was completely at fault because, as you just said, you can't tell them that you're only going to attack you this year and then we're getting on next year because they simply go to ground and wait till you're gone.
Right.
Which is what's happened. They've really stepped up their tempo, their mission tempo of attacking our forces, and particularly the Afghan government's forces. And they're able to recruit because they seem to be winning. You know, when they seem to be losing or on the run, it's hard for them to recruit. When they seem to be winning, it's easy to recruit.
Exactly. Let's talk a little bit about North Korea. We've talked about it several times before, and this morning I sent you that article that came out at the American Thinker, one of the guys who writes there, I forgot the gentleman's name right now, but he wrote it's one of the most interesting articles that I've ever read, because he basically said that we could actually destroy North Korea rather quickly, which. Maybe I misunderstood the article, but that's what I thought he was saying. And yet I guess there's always that window of potential problem where if you're wrong by 10%, and let's say you destroy 90% of their war machine, they can still get a lot of missiles. They can still fire a lot of missiles and kill a lot of civilians, Barry.
Yeah, his article, the article in the Thinker, was interesting. It was basically laying out a scenario whereby we'd make a decapitation strike to take out their weapons of mass destruction and their missiles, you know, as well as the nuclear stockpiles, and possibly their government as well. We'd use things like MOABs, which are the mother of all bombs, and was used recently in Afghanistan. These are often called bunker busters. These are basically weapons that penetrate deep into the ground before they explode and are meant to not take out exactly what we'd be dealing with, which is this ant's nest of underground tunnels where Kim keeps a lot of his reserves and keeps his nuclear stockpile. All that is probably true. The article lays out a scenario which is very plausible. What it doesn't address at all is the North Korean retaliation. If you don't kill Kim and his leadership, you have to presume they're going to take a licking but keep on ticking, because taking out their nuclear stockpile is not going to take out their conventional army. Their conventional army is very large, as we talked about before. They have something in the area of 5,000 tanks, about 1 million men on active duty, and about another 6 million in reserve, which should be called up by this point or be on the verge of being called up. Have another 950, you know, jet fighter planes. They got 76 submarines off the coast, looking to sink an American aircraft carrier, and any other ship they can as well. But most deadly of all for the South Koreans, they have some 13,000 artillery pieces stationed within firing range of Seoul. So, and by the way, speaking of their nuclear arsenal, just back up for a second here. If we didn't get all of it in that first strike, and they let's just say, for the sake of argument, this happens a few months down the road or even a year down the road. Let's say it happens right now. It doesn't much matter. At some point, they may now or may soon in the future have a missile capable of reaching either Hawaii or the West Coast. Most analysts think they can hit the West Coast right now. Maybe not accurately, but they can hit the West Coast. They only have to get lucky once. What if a nuclear tipped, and one of the reasons this is coming to a head is because they've gotten to the point now we think they can put a warhead, nuclear warhead on their missiles. you know, they miniaturized the warheads enough to fit it on a missile. During this decapitation strike, they managed to launch a few of those missiles before they get destroyed. It's only a 40-minute drive from their launch sites to New York City. It's about a 35-minute drive across the Pacific Ocean to Los Angeles, and even less to Waikiki and Pearl Harbor. Now you've driven the death toll from probably 2 million South Koreans in Seoul being destroyed by artillery to maybe a million more Americans being killed by a nuclear attack. If they hit San Diego, they could catch our fleet in port and destroy a large part of our Pacific Ocean fleet as well.
Right. No, it is really awful, the choices here. But I keep thinking that if they are as crazy as they pretend to be, then it's either going to be, you know, either you take the chance that they kill a bunch of civilians in South Korea, or you take the chance that, as you just indicated, that they hit San Diego. I mean, they're both civilians. I'm not saying one's better than the other, but I'm simply saying that it just seems to me more and more that this is, like you say, this is coming to a head, because it seems like they've crossed the point of no return. North Korea has done something under this young man that they didn't do with his father or grandfather. Those two guys were more, I guess, you know, they were crazy and they were as corrupt as they could be, but somehow they understood their limitations. I don't think this young man does, and it's pretty scary, Barry.
Well, you know, I think you got three generations of crazy going here, and they've been worshipped, this family's been worshipped as all-powerful, all-wise god kings of North Korea, now going to a third generation, so maybe they're just starting to believe their own propaganda.
They could be. Now, I did hear one thing. One thing I wanted to say very quickly, because I made me a note, I wanted to make sure I got this in. I was listening to an analysis today that, yes, they have a very big army. You're exactly right. They do. But most of their equipment is really untested. A lot of it is older equipment. And they don't really have enough food to feed their army. So it's not exactly like this is a happy army. I mean, it's not like, let's say, the army of South Korea that is much better fed and has much better equipment. Now, that's kind of an interesting analysis. I had not heard that before. Have you heard that before?
I have, and it's an interesting point, but it's fairly irrelevant to our point, which is how much damage they could do in a short-term war. That's a long-term problem. You know, that you can't feed your troops for 6 months after the war starts is a down-the-road problem. For us, the main problem is what happens in the first week while they're leveling, you know, the city of Seoul with artillery. The first
right,
day
exactly.
When they're hitting the American 2nd Division, which is right across that border, and the troops in their barracks are being woke up early in the morning with artillery landing all around them.
Mm-hmm.
So, long-term, they have no prospect of winning, but in the very short-term, they can do a whole lot of damage.
No, you're exactly right. But it is really a frightening situation. Some people say that it's sort of like the Cuban Missile Crisis kind of situation, except the difference, I would say, is that in the Cuban Missile Crisis, Nikita Khrushchev really didn't want to go to war with the United States. He understood that that would be a huge mistake. But again, this guy in North Korea, seems awfully crazy to me. But before we run out of time, Barry, let's quickly go to the doors and light my fire. It was 50 years ago this week that Light My Fire was number one. And there's two versions of that song for people like me who are interested in things like that. There's the 45, which is the one that most of the time you heard on Top 40 radio back then. And you still have that version in some of their CDs. And then, of course, you had the long 7-minute version, 6 minutes, 50 seconds, with that big
right.
organ solo in the middle. I don't know. I mean, I guess it depends what kind of mood I'm in as to which one I like. But I thought it was a great song. And it really sort of, you know, people are still enjoying that song 50 years later. So it must be pretty good, Barry.
Well, yeah, it was, and there's apparently a professor of music at I think it was Brigham Young University did analysis of the long version and the short version, found that the long version was recorded inaccurately, that it's recorded too slow, that the most pure, according to the sheet music, the most accurate version is either the Doors' live concert versions, which we have on tape, or the 45, which had the right speed. So when they remastered it, I think in 2006, they remastered it correctly. But if you go back and listen to the original recordings of the long version, it's slower than the short version. It's kind of neither here nor there, but it's kind of an interesting tidbit of, you know, Doors trivia.
Well, for people like you and me, we find that stuff interesting. I always thought that first album by the Doors had that 12-minute song on the second side of the album called The End, where he says,
"Great song."
One has to be one of the greatest lyrics in pop history. Maybe not a nice lyric, but very interesting lyric when he says, "Mother, I want to kill you," or "Father, I want to kill you," something like that, which didn't go over real well with our parents back then. But nevertheless, it was on the second side of their album. The name of the song, it's called "The End," and it
can
was
I,
kind
can
of
I tell
a
little story about that.
Yeah, please.
Can I?
You have a few stories.
I'm a huge Doors fan. I've read several books. One was Danny Sugarman's "No One Here Gets Out Alive." Sugarman was a big fanboy and worked in their press office during the time of the band. And another one is Ray Manzarek, the keyboard player's biography of Jim Morrison called "Light My Fire." Manzarek was the keyboard player, as I just said, and he and Jim formed the band, brought in Robbie Krieger, the guitar player, and then John Densmore, the drummer. The Doors were only a 4-man band. They didn't even have a bass player. Manzarek would play keyboard with his right hand, and then he played bass with his left hand on with the keyboard. So when they did "Light My Fire," they had to bring in a guest. After they originally laid down the track, they brought in a guest bass player to actually bring in a bass guitar. But normally it was never done except with those four men, and the bass was provided by the keyboard. So I told you that, so I can tell you this. So they formed the band. Their early gigs were at some clubs in Los Angeles in 1966. And they were discovered by Elektra Records president Jack Holzman when they were playing as the featured band, the so-called house band, at the Whiskey A Go-Go on Sunset Boulevard, which is still there today, and it's an icon. They were honing their skills, and all the songs you hear on that first album, which is self-titled The Doors, from which "Light My Fire" was one of the hit singles that came out of that. All those songs were played every night, and as they got better and better at it, they're at the Whiskey. So on August 21st, 1966, they were being viewed by Paul Rothschild and Jack Holzman, who were scouting talent. And Jim Morrison got up and did "The End." And it's a long song, a long version. And in the middle of it, he goes into this riff. And it's on the album, but apparently this was the first time he had ever done it, that riff, where he talks about the killer awoke at dawn. He put his boots on. He walked down the hall, and he goes on and shoots his parents. He walks in his father's room, and he says, "Father, I want to kill you. Mother, I want to have blah, blah, sex with you." But he said it very explicitly, a sort of Oedipal rage. And that's what the Doors were all about. They were all about channeling mythology and metaphor. The very name, the Doors, comes from The Doors of Perception, Alex Huxley's book, The Doors of Perception. They were very intellectual, the two of them, Manzarek and Morrison. But as he's doing "The End," he yells out, "Mother, I want to F you." And the owner of the bar, the Whiskey, was listening also, and he lost his mind. He came unglued. Because in 1966, you didn't do that sort of thing.
No,
he didn't talk about screwing your mother.
I'm not sure you can do it today. Well, I'm not
right.
sure you could do it today, right? Yeah, but when you were talking about Whiskey's Go-Go, isn't that where Johnny Rivers used to do his shows or where he recorded some albums? I don't know.
Many,
I just
many.
That name rings a bell, yeah.
Yeah, many great artists. They're in the Troubadour, were the two great clubs in the 60s.
Yeah,
But that got them booted out of the whiskey. They were fired that night, and they were signed by Elektra Records within a day.
Well, he also had some troubles with Ed Sullivan when he sang "Light My Fire."
Ed Sullivan
was furious with him for I guess some of his movements. But that album was actually a pretty good album. That first album, "The Crystal Ship," is a very good song. "Break On Through" is a very good song. 20th Century Fox, I think, is the name of that other song. And
mm-hmm.
I thought that's actually one of the better albums of that period. But I have to tell you that if I had to pick one song to listen to, if I only had one song by the Doors to listen to, it would be "Riders in the Storm." I thought that was the arrangement of that song. It was just fantastic. I thought that was really a great, not just great lyrics and all of that, great image of the song, but just great arrangement. I thought that was one of their best. Do you like that one?
I love it. The last album was L.A. Woman. It was released in 1971. By the way, the Doors had 20 gold, 14 platinum, 5 multi-platinum, and 1 diamond album in the United States. They're enormously successful. Every one of their albums reached the top 10, Billboard top 10. Many of their songs were in the top 10, as well as their albums. They never had an album that didn't succeed, was not at least a gold album, or if not gold platinum. So that's the first thing I say about them. Second thing is L.A. Woman comes at a time when the band was on the verge of breaking up, and it's the last burst of creativity. The title track, L.A. Woman, is one of my favorite songs by the Doors. But "Riders on a Storm" also was a great song. "Touch Me" was a great song. "Hello,
yes.
I Love You."
That was a single. "Touch Me" was a single. That was a big hit for them. "Hello, I Love You" was also a big hit for them.
By the way, if I may throw in there real quickly, Jim Morrison wrote most of the lyrics to most of these songs before the Doors ever got formed. After he finished film school at UCLA, and by the time he met Ray Manzarek 2 years later on Venice Beach, he had written volumes of poetry. And later was released by the Doors after he died in a series of poems called "American Prayer," 1978. But most of those lyrics were written by him, except for two songs written by Robbie Krieger. One was "Light My Fire," mm-hmm. and the other one was "Touch Me."
Well, it's just fascinating. They're just a very good group, and when you realize that, you know, Morrison died 46 years, 1971. He died 46 years ago, meaning that there hasn't been anything new, including Morrison. I mean, I know that they've done some efforts by the other three guys have done some work by themselves, but there hasn't been anything new from Jim Morrison for 46 years. It is amazing that they continue to sell records. They are truly one of those groups that, you know, it seems that every new generation picks them up.
Can I throw in one last trivial piece?
Sure.
Jim Morrison's father was an admiral, U.S. Navy admiral. He was the commander of the American naval forces at the Gulf of Tonkin incident. Did you know that?
No, I did not know that. No, I did not know that, but I did learn something the other day that I thought was rather interesting about Jim Morrison. His high school classmate was none other than Cass Elliot of the Mamas and the Papas. I learned that the other day, and I said, man, what a small world.
I did not know that.
They went to George Washington High School in Virginia, which may very well be the connection to the military, that his father was in the military. So that's another, you know, one of those bits of trivia you pick up here and there, but
his father was Rear Admiral George Morrison, who commanded the naval forces in the Gulf of Tonkin incident. And by the way, Jim Morrison, the singer, the son, when his father heard that his son had a band out in L.A., his response was bunk. He says, Jim can't sing, because Morrison his entire life was afraid to sing. When they first formed the band The Doors, he had to turn his back on the audience for the first 6 weeks they were at the first club they ever opened at, which wasn't the Whiskey. It was another one. I can't remember the name of it. But the first time he was on stage for the first 6 weeks, he had to turn and sing with his back to the audience because he couldn't see the audience without getting stage fright.
Wow.
He was terrified.
That I did not know. Wow. Well, we're going to have to say goodnight in a hurry here, Barry, but as always, it's an absolute treat to have you. And now that I know you're such a fan of the Doors or so knowledgeable about the Doors, maybe we'll get something from the Doors for musical background in the future. I'll see what I can find.
Well, you have to come out to Los Angeles, and I'll take you to the whiskey.
All right, let's do that. Good night, my friend.
Good night.
All right. Well, that's going to do it, folks. Thanks for listening, my good friend Barry Jacobson. What a great show tonight about World War II and everything else. Good night, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.